In this talk, Dr. Martos discusses the origins and development of the liturgy of Christian marriages. He describes how, for many centuries, the wedding ceremony was not an ecclesiastical practice at all, but gradually came to be a church ceremony in the Middle Ages. He also shows how church rules regarding marriage and divorce eventually led to the position that a valid sacramental marriage between Christians could never be dissolved. Today, however, this somewhat legalistic attitude toward marriage is giving way to a more personalistic approach. On the one hand, this allows for more personal variety in the wedding ceremony itself, and on the other hand, it forces the church to re-examine long-held legalistic beliefs.
It is hard to talk about the New Testament teaching on marriage without also touching on the topic of divorce. And this is true for two reasons. One is that the New Testament says very little directly and explicitly about marriage, and a number of texts that refer to marriage also bring in the question of the permanence of marriage versus the possibility of separation. The other is that much of the traditional Catholic teaching on marriage has focused on the issue of indissolubility, and theologians since the Middle Ages have used the New Testament texts on marriage to support the Church's official prohibition of divorce and remarriage for Catholics. In the Gospels of Mark and Luke, for example, the only time that Jesus explicitly talks about marriage is when he flatly condemns divorce and remarriage for either men or women. In the parallel text in Matthew's Gospel, however, we again find a denunciation of divorce, but with two slight modifications. First, it speaks only about husbands divorcing wives and not about either spouse divorcing the other. Second, it seems to say that it is wrong for husbands to divorce their wives except in the case of immorality. Scripture scholars today suggest that the text in Matthew and Luke, which flatly condemns divorce, is probably closer to the actual teaching of Jesus himself. There are a number of places in the Gospels where Jesus uses hyperbole to emphasize the stark demands of his moral ideals. Love your enemies, he says. Do good not in open, but in secret. Cut off your hand if it commits a sin. It is within this context, the context of the seemingly unreachable ideals which set something like moral standards for those who allow the Gospel to reign in their hearts, it is within this context that Jesus' apodictic rejection of divorce as a way out of marital difficulties ought to be read. What we find in the Gospel of Matthew, Scripture scholars go on to suggest, is a slightly amended or modified version of this statement of the Christian ideal. It's probably the way that Jesus' statement was understood within the Jewish Christian community out of which Matthew's Gospel came. The Jews traditionally allowed only husbands to divorce their wives. Wives could not divorce their husbands under Jewish law. And they allowed this only if the wife was immoral. Some Jewish rabbis interpreted this to mean gross immorality, such as adultery. Other rabbis suggested that even the slightest wrongdoing on the part of the wife could be grounds for divorce. We cannot be sure, then, what kind of immorality Matthew had in mind when he suggested that Jesus would permit divorce by the husband if the wife was immoral. But we can be sure that, in the minds of some early Christians at least, divorce was not entirely impossible. We find something of the same attitude in the letters of St. Paul. In writing to the Christians at Corinth, he held up the ideal that Christian marriage partners should remain married despite all difficulties. But he also admitted that there could be some intolerable situations, such as a marriage between a Christian and a non-believer, where it might be better if the partners separated. And even though it was better for the Christian to remain single, there might even be cases where he or she would do better to remarry. Of course, the most famous exposition of the ideal of Christian marriage in the New Testament was one which does not mention divorce at all, but which does talk a lot about fidelity. It is found in the fifth chapter of the Epistle to the Ephesians, which was written either by St. Paul himself or by someone close to Paul in his theology. The epistle teaches that husbands and wives should be faithful to each other in the same way that Christ gave himself in love to the church, and that the church submits in love to Christ. There are some other references to Christian marriage in the letters to Timothy and in the first epistle of Peter, but these are mainly practical rather than theological treatments of marriage, giving suggestions about how good Christian men and women ought to behave towards one another. They still held up fidelity, reverence, and submission as moral ideals for those who married in the law. But they don't suggest that the model for their marriage relationship was the spiritual relationship between Christ and his church. From this brief survey of the biblical texts, it is clear that the New Testament in no way talks explicitly about a Christian wedding ceremony or even about a sacrament of marriage. The same holds true if we examine the few writings that we have of the early church fathers on the subject of marriage. This is not to say that marriage was not sacred. It was. But there is little evidence to suggest that it was considered to be a sacrament in the later Catholic sense of that term. The situation seems to be that when Christians married, they got married according to the customs of the society in which they lived. For those who came from strong family backgrounds, it was often customary for weddings to be arranged by the fathers of the couple to be married, and the fathers also presided over the exchange of vows, the handing over of the dowry, the wedding feast, and so on. For those who wished to marry without their family's consent, it was even possible under Roman law, both before and after the Roman Empire became Christian, for two people who were legally of age to marry each other and begin to live together. It was as simple as that. If, in either case, either the family wedding or the private wedding, a priest or bishop happened to be present, it was purely by way of invitation to ask his blessing on the newly married couple. In fact, it was even something of an honor to have a representative of the church present at a wedding ceremony. It was not something that bishops or priests did for all Christian marriages. So marriage in the patristic church was sacred and solemn, just as it is in most religious cultures. And for Christians, it often had an added dimension of being something holy and salvific for both husband and wife. But there is also some evidence that in certain cases, even Christian marriages might break down or break apart. And in these cases, remarriage was sometimes allowed. The clearest evidence is in the case of husbands who divorced their wives who had committed some grossly immoral act, such as adultery. Some patristic bishops allowed this practice of divorce because it seemed to be sanctioned by the words of Jesus in the Gospel according to Matthew. They didn't like it, and they didn't encourage it, but they allowed it in special circumstances, and they even allowed the men to remarry. Women, on the other hand, were not allowed to divorce their husbands because this was not permitted by the Gospel text. Nor were they allowed to remarry if they had been divorced by their husbands. Some church fathers, such as St. Basil the Great, frankly admitted that this was a double standard, one standard for men and another for women. But they felt that there was nothing that they could do about it since it seemed to be sanctioned by the words of the Gospel. About the most that they could do when Christian men or women violated these Gospel standards was to impose penances on them and then later readmit them to communion following the practice of public penitence. For it was still possible under Roman law for wives to divorce their husbands, for husbands to dismiss their wives, and for both of them to separate by mutual agreement. As Christianity gained greater influence in the later Roman Empire, the acceptable grounds for legal divorce were gradually tightened. But divorce in certain circumstances, such as adultery, desertion, or imprisonment, was always legally possible in the Christian Roman Empire. This legal attitude towards divorce and remarriage is still found today in the practice of the Eastern Orthodox churches. Those churches do not grant divorces, but when they occur for serious reasons, they do allow for civilly divorced partners to remarry in the church if the partners are sincere and serious about making their second marriage a truly Christian one to the best of their ability. the ideal of Christian marriage in both East and the West, in both the Eastern and the Western Roman Empire throughout the patristic period, however, still remained a lofty one. It was that husbands and wives should love one another, for all Christians are supposed to love one another in the same way that Christ loved, that is, with full fidelity and commitment, even to the point of sacrificing their lives for one another. It was not until early in the 5th century, however, that a great Catholic thinker of the patristic period gave a thorough theological explanation of the meaning of Christian marriage. That thinker was St. Augustine, the Bishop of Hippo in northern Africa. And the reason he turned his attention specifically to writing about marriage is that there were other intellectuals in his day who were downgrading marriage and who were saying that sexual intercourse is always dirty and immoral. Augustine, therefore, wrote in defense of marriage, arguing that marriage has a number of benefits for individuals, for society in general, and for the church in particular. One good thing that comes from marriage, Augustine reasoned, is children. It gives people offspring who will give joy to their youth and give support in their old age. It thus provides society with the population it needs to perpetuate itself, and it likewise gives the church new members who can come to know, love, and eventually be with God. The second good that comes from marriage, Augustine continued, is fidelity. Fidelity makes the relationship better for the individuals because they know they can trust and rely on the other person. And fidelity is also a good thing for the children produced by sexual intercourse. It gives them a stable family and the loving support of two parents. Augustine recognized, however, that these first two benefits are found in any marriage, whether Christian or not. And so he asked, is there anything especially good about Christian marriage? After meditating on the epistle to the Ephesians, he concluded that there is. He saw that, according to St. Paul, the model of Christian marriage is found in the relationship between Christ and the church. And he reasoned that if this is true, then it is also true that any Christian marriage is a reflection of that model. In other words, it is an image or sign of the relationship between Christ and the church, and because it is a sign of a sacred reality, it deserves to be called a sacred sign, a sacramentum in Latin. The third good thing that came only from Christian marriages, therefore, was this sacramentum, the sacred sign of the faithful union between Christ and the church. And from this, Augustine reasoned that the sacramentum or sacrament of marriage must be something permanent. Why? Because what it signified was an everlasting relationship of love and fidelity between Christ and the church. And it could not truly signify this unless the marriage itself was a long-lasting relationship of love and fidelity between two people. During the patristic period, then, St. Augustine and other bishops recognized the reality and the value of Christian marriage. But there was really no such thing as a Christian marriage or wedding ceremony until the 6th or 7th century. It developed first in the eastern churches of Greece and Asia Minor, where the custom of asking for the priest's blessing developed into a custom of asking him to take a more active role in the wedding ceremony, and eventually what had become customary was recognized as legal in the 8th century, and it even became mandatory in later centuries. In the Western Church, which covered most of Europe, however, the development of a church marriage ceremony came about somewhat differently. Europe in the early Middle Ages, remember, witnessed the downfall of the Roman Empire and, with it, the collapse of its judicial system. In the absence of imperial magistrates, therefore, bishops were sometimes called upon to preside over cases about who was legally engaged to whom, about who was lawfully married to whom, and about who had a right to get a divorce and remarry. And so, willingly or unwillingly, church officials were being called upon to play a legal role in matters pertaining to marriage. Around this same time in Europe, the old Roman Empire was being invaded and settled by Germanic tribes from the north, and Christian missionaries were working their way northward to baptize and Christianize these pagan barbarians. These tribal peoples, however, had marriage customs which differed from those that had long prevailed in Rome. In the Roman Empire, a legal marriage came into existence when the two people involved gave their consent to each other to become husband and wife. The Germanic tribes, on the other hand, had a much more paternalistic arrangement. It was the fathers of the young man and woman who had to agree to the marriage, and the agreement itself was regarded as only a betrothal until the first wedding night. That first act of sexual intercourse sealed the arrangement, so to speak, or consummated the marriage. In Germanic tribal custom, in other words, the children's consent really didn't enter into the legal bindingness of a marriage. Naturally, as the centuries passed, the tribes became more Romanized, the old empire became more Germanicized, and conflicts arose around these two quite different approaches to the legality of marriage. In Roman law, two young people could marry each other even without their parents' consent, and even without any witnesses to the marriage. In Germanic law, they couldn't even get legally engaged without their parents' consent, and the marriage itself didn't come into legal existence until it was consummated by intercourse. More and more, bishops were called upon to decide marriage cases because they were often the only educated and responsible leaders in society to whom both nobles and commoners could appeal for a hopefully impartial and enlightened decision. Moreover, to protect people from possible abuses of the practice of secret marriage, that is, marriage contracted without any witnesses, church officials in the 9th century began to lay down rules stipulating that all marriages ought to be witnessed or blessed by a priest. In practice, this meant that a lot of weddings began to take place near a church or country chapel. Then the ceremony was moved into the church vestibule, from which the married couple could easily proceed to the altar to receive the priest's nuptial blessing. And eventually, the natural momentum of things brought that ceremony right to the altar rail itself, where the priest not only witnessed and blessed the marriage, but also began to perform the wedding itself, taking over the position in the ceremony previously held by the fathers of the bride and groom. By the 12th century, this process of liturgical development, the development of a church wedding ceremony and nuptial mass, was more or less complete. And this, of course, was the same time during which the great medieval schools were being founded and during which the schoolmen were beginning to develop scholastic theology and canon law. Since marriage was now a church ceremony that most Catholics went through at some point in their lives, it was natural for Peter Lombard to include it in his list of ecclesiastical rituals that came to be known as the Seven Sacraments. Another reason for including it among the official sacraments was the notion that sacraments were supposed to be effective rituals, and the marriage ceremony did, of course, have definite social and ecclesial effects. It made two people bonded in matrimony who before had been single, and it interwove the families that they came from in a social network of in-laws. But it also had ecclesial effects in that it immediately involved them in the Christian understanding of what it meant to be a dutiful husband or wife, and it made them subject to canonical regulations regarding dowries and other personal property, the legitimacy and illegitimacy of offspring, and so on. Now, it seems that the schoolmen who treated marriage as a sacrament had the same difficulty with it that they had had with extreme unction, namely its institution by Christ. Marriage evidently existed before Jesus' time, and there is nothing in the New Testament, apart from his presence at the wedding feast at Cana, which suggests that he ever did anything connected with weddings. Jesus did, however, emphasize the permanence of marriage, and he did apparently abrogate the Jewish law of divorce. And to the medievals, this was sufficient evidence to show that Christian marriage was meant by Christ to be a new and different institution from what it had been in the past. Furthermore, the Latin translation of the Epistle to the Ephesians did use the word sacramentum to refer to marriage. And Augustine, in commenting upon the Latin text, had taken this to mean that marriage was a sacrament in the same way that baptism was a sacrament. That is to say, it is a sign of a sacred reality which came into being when two people were married and which could not be lost while both of them were still alive. Thus, to the medieval mind at least, there seemed to be sufficient evidence in both the scriptures and the patristic tradition for including marriage among the official sacraments of the church. Moreover, at the same time that the theologians were reaching these conclusions about the sacramentality of marriage, the canon lawyers in the church were reaching very similar conclusions about the legalities of marriage, and especially about its permanence. After a long debate in the medieval universities about over when and how a marriage came into existence, it was decided, largely under the influence of Pope Alexander III, who was himself a canon lawyer, that a marriage came into legal existence when two persons of the opposite sex gave their consent to each other to live together as husband and wife. However, because the two people were getting married under church law, and because marriage was a sacrament under the church's jurisdiction, the church's authority could specify what was needed for a marriage to be a valid and binding union. In the 12th century, the Pope specified that if the marriage was not yet consummated by sexual intercourse, the partners could be released from their marriage vow and be freed to marry again. Thus, in the Church's canonical legislation on marriage, the Roman tradition, which said that a marriage came into existence when two people gave their consent, and the Germanic tradition, which said that a marriage came into existence when the first act of intercourse took place, were combined in a way that satisfied the supporters of both views. And this legal solution to the question of marriage, together with the gospel ideal that Christian marriage should be permanent, and together with the theological interpretation that marriage bestowed a sacramental reality similar to the sacramental character received in baptism, led naturally to the conclusion that a valid Christian marriage could not be undone any more than a valid baptism could be undone. In other words, the marriage bond was permanent, and so a valid Christian marriage was indissoluble. The conclusion reached in the 12th century, therefore, was not that marriage as a sacred sign should not be undone, which was the way that it had been interpreted in the earlier ages. Rather, the new conclusion was that marriage as a sacrament could not be undone if it was really a sign of the permanent union between Christ and the Church. The close connection between church law and the celebration of marriage eventually had other effects on the theology of marriage as well, the most notable and long-lasting of which was the way that marriage got spoken of as a contract. It is easy to conceive of marriage as a sort of binding arrangement between two persons by which they agree to give certain rights to each other, such as the right to marital intercourse, and by which they agree to take on certain responsibilities, such as the duty to remain faithful to each other and the duty to have children and care for them. Thus, by the 14th century, it was becoming common to equate the sacrament of marriage with the bond of marriage, and the marriage bond with the marriage contract. When two people entered into a marital union, in other words, through the giving of consent, they entered into a contract which established a bond between them. But this bond was a sign of the union between Christ and the Church. And so the marriage bond, as a sacred sign, was also a sacrament. As a sacrament, it bestowed grace, both the grace to fulfill one's marital duties and the grace needed to grow in holiness in the married state. But as a contract, it came under the Church's jurisdiction to regulate what it entailed, to stipulate who could lawfully enter into marriage, and to legislate other canons regarding its validity and laicity. The bishops, even since ancient times, had used their power of binding and loosing, or the power of the keys, as it was sometimes called, to release Christians from their marriage vows and allow them to remarry. But now the church's canonical regulation was organized and codified in a more uniform manner throughout Catholic Europe. Divorce was no longer permitted by church law, because in the scholastic view of the sacrament, it was not possible to separate what God had joined together. Even if husbands and wives should separate, they were still considered to be sacramentally and legally married, and so they could not validly enter into a second marriage. The only possibility of separation and remarriage that remained was the annulment of the first marriage. That is to say, if an ecclesiastical court reviewed the facts concerning a certain marriage and concluded that because in the first case there had been some irregularity or violation of the church's canons regarding marriage, for example, if one of the parties was already married, or if the two persons were too closely related, or if one of the spouses had been forced into marriage against their will, if there was some irregularity of this sort, then the church could declare that the apparent marriage was really no marriage at all, that it was annulled, that the contract was null and void and therefore not binding, and in this case, one or both of the marriage partners might be free to enter into a new, valid marriage. One can easily see that with the marriage bond protected on all sides, with so many canonical regulations and legal procedures, annulments in those days were few and far between. And as a matter of fact, the most famous case in church history concerning marriage revolved about the refusal of the ecclesiastical court in Rome to grant King Henry VIII of England an annulment of his first marriage so that he might be free to marry someone else. Henry's first wife, Catherine of Aragon, had been related to him by marriage, and so he had to get a dispensation from the church's laws in order to validly marry her. Catherine, however, didn't give Henry a male heir to the throne, and so he wanted to have the dispensation withdrawn, which would then invalidate his marriage to Catherine and leave Henry free to marry another woman. When the Roman court refused to do this, Henry declared himself to be the head of the church in England and had his own English church court grant him the annulment that he wanted. The separation of the Church of England from the Church of Rome, then, actually revolved around the issue of annulment. In contrast, marriage was not the main issue in the separation of the other churches from Rome during the Protestant Reformation. But once that separation came about, the Reformers saw little reason to consider marriage as a sacrament or to retain the elaborate church laws regulating marriage. They agreed that marriage was something sacred and that it had a biblical foundation in the Genesis story of Adam and Eve, but they rejected the notion that it was a sacrament in the strict Catholic sense, not only because there was no direct evidence for it in the New Testament, but also because scholars who were interested in antiquity discovered that in patristic times, the state and not the church had made the laws governing marriage and divorce. Thus, the Protestant church retained the practice of church weddings, but they let the authority for legally regulating marriage, including requirements for marrying, the conditions for divorce, rights of inheritance, and so on, pass into the hands of civil government. The Council of Trent, on the other hand, which was convened to counteract the Protestant Reformation, felt obliged to reaffirm the by-then-traditional Catholic teaching on marriage, that it was a true sacrament, that it could not be dissolved, and that the Church had the authority to make laws regulating marriage. This post-Reformation understanding of the sacramentality and legality of marriage continued to be the Catholic view through the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. During the 20th century, however, and especially in recent days, things have begun to change. The Catholic Church's laws on marriage are pretty much the same as they used to be, although there has been some relaxation of the laws regarding so-called mixed marriages because of the growing number of marriages between Catholics and non-Catholics. On the other hand, the Catholic theology of marriage during the past 30 years has begun to undergo some radical changes, so much so that there is, in fact, something of a discrepancy between the theology of marriage and the regulations governing it in the Catholic Church. The scholastic theology, as we have seen, had become rather legalistic. That is, much of it was couched in legal terminology such as marriage contract, rights, and duties. But the contemporary theology of marriage is much more personalistic, viewing the relationship between husband and wife as one of mutual love and support. The older view, reminiscent of St. Augustine's discussion of the three goods or benefits of marriage, saw the primary purpose of marriage as the establishment of a family, the procreation and raising of children for the benefit of parents, society, and the church. And so the family and society at large needed the protection of strict regulation by the church. Today, however, many people, including contemporary Catholics, no longer look upon marriage in quite this way. They often view the primary purpose of marriage as a commitment in love between two individuals, from which children may or may not result as an expression of that love. The Second Vatican Council largely endorsed this view, and so it chose to speak of marriage in terms of commitment, covenant, and mutual self-giving, rather than in terms of contract, rights, and duties. But this then creates a tension between the contemporary theology of marriage and the Church's traditional laws on marriage and divorce. The contemporary view suggests that it is not every marriage relationship, but only a relationship of love, fidelity, commitment, and support, which is symbolic of the relationship between Christ and the Church, as it is described in the Epistle to the Ephesians, and which is therefore, in this sense, sacramental. But the traditional view and the canon law which embodies this view regards every valid marriage as sacramental, regardless of the actual concrete relationship between a husband and wife, even if they have come to hate each other, even if they are separated from one another, even if they have gotten a civil divorce. To remedy this situation somewhat, canon lawyers during the past 10 years or so have been doing their best to work within the Church's legal statutes, especially the regulations regarding annulment, to allow Catholics who find themselves in unhappy and even intolerable marriages, and who have tried every other means, such as psychological and pastoral counseling, to improve their marriages, they have been trying to allow Catholics to seek to have their marriages annulled on somewhat broader grounds than had been allowed in the past. And they've been trying to find ways for Catholics who have gotten a civil divorce, but who now want to remain Catholic and to remarry in the Church, to have their first marriages annulled, again on broader grounds than had been previously allowed. To some extent, this has worked, but to some extent, the solution has created as many problems as it sought to solve. For if marriages that everyone once thought were valid and sacramental are now declared to have been invalid and non-sacramental, how can the average person know whether his or her marriage is actually valid or invalid? Some pastors and dioceses have been making strong attempts during the past few years to prepare young Catholics for sound and happy marriages which are less likely to fail in the future, to help married couples and families to cope with the stresses of marriage and to enrich their marriage relationship, and to counsel divorced and separated Catholics who need support in trying to live without a spouse or who want to return to the sacraments after getting remarried. But it is not easy. For as long as there exists this discrepancy between the contemporary understanding of marriage, which is now increasingly reflected in the Catholic theology of marriage on the one hand, and the present Church laws regarding marriage, which reflect the traditional scholastic theology of marriage, on the other hand, the tension between these two and the problems created by that tension will continue to exist.